Yeah, they're usually available on.
Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Maher, and I'll be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 under the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships here locally, in D.C., and in 35 nations around the globe. Hinckley also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences in D.C., and over $400,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website, hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is Conservation Challenges, the trend in how we are making a difference today. Our guest will be Mary Wagner, but first, please welcome me in welcoming Thad Hall, the Director of the Grad Studies here at the University of Utah and Director of the Master of Public Administration. Thank you.
We're here today to hear Mary Wagner deliver the Domus Nelson Lecture, and we're fortunate today to have Domus here to introduce Mary. Domus was the original director of the MPA program and was a professor here at the University of Utah until 1995 when he retired. He has an undergraduate degree from the University of Utah and a PhD from Harvard, where he studied with legendary scholars such as Carl Friedrich and John Gauss. His legacy touches our students today through the Domus Nelson Best Paper Award, which we award annually, and the Domus Nelson Lectureship, both of which were established on his behalf and to which he contributes generously. So let me welcome Domus to up here to introduce Mary.
This is a great privilege. Mary worked full-time and commuted to the University of Utah to earn her Master of Public Administration degree. She first commuted from Roosevelt, Utah, while she worked at the Vernal Ranger Station. She was promoted to be deputy supervisor on the Humboldt-Toyabe National Forest and commuted here all the way from Reno, Nevada. Before completing her degree, she was appointed deputy supervisor and then supervisor of the Dixie National Forest based in Cedar City, Utah. After completing her degree, she became deputy regional forester in Ogden, Utah, and then served as a regional forester in Portland, Oregon. She then moved to Washington, D.C., and was the first director of the U.S. Forest Service's Wilderness, Wild, and Scenic Rivers program. She was promoted to Assistant Director of Recreation, Heritage, and Wilderness Resources, and today she is the Associate Director of the United States Forest Service. Mary Wagner's lecture is entitled Conservation Challenges, the Trends, and How We Are Making a Difference Today. Please join me in welcoming Mary Wagner back to the University of Utah.
Well, thanks, and good afternoon. It's really quite a privilege to be back here. I want to just acknowledge the warm welcome that I've received from faculty and students here at the university. Utah is really a place that I call home, and I mean that literally. I have a house still in Ogden, and when I stop working one day, I'll come back here and really call this home. I encountered the Forest Service first as a member of something called the Young Adult Conservation Corps in Southern California. So those of you who may be working with youth programs or connecting youth with nature, I'm a byproduct of one of those programs. You may be actually working with a future associate chief or chief of the Forest Service, so important work. But my professional roots were mostly here in the interior West, as Dalmas mentioned. And I consider the Intermountain West home, a place that I'll call home, a place that I love. So thanks for inviting me back. I'm going to share a little bit about what the Forest Service does. I'd like you to leave here with a little bit of sense of what this remarkable organization does. And it's us and others for so much of our work. And I hope I instill a sense that you, too, can have a share and a part of managing and stewarding our resources into the future. So I'm going to share a little bit about what the mission of the Forest Service is, a little bit about what we do, some of the contemporary conservation challenges today, and they're large and they're daunting, and then some of the exciting trends and ways that people are showing up in pursuit of conservation that I think is really inspirational and should give us all great hope. So the mission of the Forest Service is to sustain the health, diversity, and productivity of the nation's forests and grasslands for present and future generations. So anchored in sustainability, a long-term arc for present and future generations. The mission includes helping Americans use and enjoy the lands and waters that belong to them as citizens of the United States. The Forest Service manages a system of national forests and grasslands on an area almost twice the size of California, 193 million acres, in 44 states and Puerto Rico. These lands entrusted to our care provide some of the richest resources and most breathtaking scenery in the nation, as well as drinking water for hundreds of Americans. As the nation's leading forestry organization, we also serve Americans in other ways. The Forest Service was founded in 1905 to stop the degradation of watersheds and manage the lands for the benefit of all Americans. To that end, in addition to the National Forest System, agency programs support the sustainable stewardship of more than 600 million acres of forest land across the nation, including 423 million acres of private forest land, 68 million acres of state forest land, 18 million acres of tribal forests, and 100 million acres of urban and community forests. In addition, we maintain one of the largest forestry research organizations in the world, with more than a century of discoveries in such areas as wood and forest products, fire behavior and fire management, and sustainable forest management. In an age of global interconnectedness, we also support sustainable stewardship of forests around the world. We've served people in over 80 countries globally, offering technical assistance to manage forest resources, assistance and professional expertise in protected area management, natural resource governance and laws, disaster assistance, and finally, policy work in global forums focused on abating things like illegal logging, addressing climate impacts, invasive species, and fostering conservation. America's forests and grasslands and other open spaces are really integral to the social, ecological, and economic well-being of the nation. The benefits from Forest Service programs and activities includes jobs and economic activity, especially around rural areas. In 2011, for example, various activities on national forests contributed over $36 billion to America's gross domestic product, supporting nearly 450,000 jobs. The most popular uses of the national forests and grasslands are associated with outdoor recreation. Our increasingly diverse visitor populations engages in all kinds of activity, from hiking, picnicking, bird watching, driving for pleasure, skiing, snowboarding, hunting, off-highway vehicle riding, wildlife viewing, visiting cultural sites and visitor centers. The national forests and grasslands attract about 166 million visits per year, supporting about 205,000 jobs and contributing $13.6 billion to the gross domestic product each year. 55% of our visitors engage in strenuous physical activity, contributing to their health and well-being. Non-commercial uses of forests and grasslands also provide vital benefits to the American people. For example, more than half of our nation's fresh water flows from public and private forest land, and about 60 million Americans rely on drinking water that originates on the national forest system. Forest Service land management, combined with Forest Service assistance to private landowners, helps protect the single greatest drinking source of drinking water in the nation. Pretty remarkable. We could be considered the water company for the nation. The Forest Service's creation of jobs and economic opportunities is not limited to rural areas. And we also have Job Corps centers and other programs where we provide technical training and employment for America's urban youth, and we help veterans transition back to civilian life. Our urban and community forestry program has also provided jobs and career training opportunities for underemployed adults and at-risk youth through activities such as tree care and riparian corridor restoration. We also engage with a wide range of partners who contribute to investments in land management project and activities. In 2013, we entered into more than 8,000 grants and agreements with partner organizations who contributed a total value of $540 million, either in cash or in-kind contributions. Combined with the Forest Service's contribution of a little over $700 million, the total value of this partnership work is just over $1.2 billion. Very significant work we do with others. The growing value of grants and agreements demonstrates the increased importance of partnerships in fulfilling the Forest Service mission. More than 50% of the nation's forests, over 420 million acres, are privately owned. Working with state foresters, we help state foresters manage and private landowners manage America's working forests sustainably. Through our Forest Health Protection Program, for example, we monitor and assess forest health conditions on all lands nationwide, both public and private, tracking outbreaks of insect and disease, and providing funding for treating areas at risk. We have a forest inventory and analysis piece of work, and the Forest Service provides a census of the nation's forests, which benefits local, state, and federal land managers. For the first 70 to 80 years of the history of the Forest Service, the agency was really focused on helping our nation develop its natural resources. The country envisioned a future of prosperity for all Americans, and we contributed to that future by helping Americans develop resources as, like timber, water, forage, and minerals, and the jobs needed to produce them. At the same time, in that first 70 to 80 years of our history, we broke new ground by setting aside the nation's first wilderness area, the Gila Wilderness, in New Mexico in 1924. It predated the Wilderness Act. I'm happy to say that this year we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act in this country. In the last 30 to 40 years, our focus has broadened to include a full range of the values and benefits that people get from forests and their grasslands, including jobs. The Forest Service plays a vital role in providing public benefits and services such as clear water, minerals and energy, fertile soils for supporting timber and forage, carbon storage, food and fiber, fish and wildlife habitat, and opportunities for outdoor recreation. Today, Americans understand that forests provide people and communities with a range of social, economic, and ecological benefits for present and future generations. What Americans want from their national forests has expanded to include a broad array of things and a broader approach to obtaining them. So we engage everyone interested in our work and in the decisions that we make. Our focus, consequently, has also expanded. We still have a multiple-use mission, but our focus is now working through partnerships and collaboration to sustain the ability of Americans' forests and grasslands, both public and private, to deliver the full range of values and benefits to millions of Americans. There are challenges, and our nation's ability to protect its forests and grassland resources is now at risk due to drought, invasive species, uncharacteristically severe wildfires, and uncharacteristically severe outbreaks of insects and diseases. Such stresses and disturbances are affecting Americans' forests and grasslands and watersheds on an unprecedented scale. The sheer scale of the challenges can be daunting, but fear not. I'm going to tell you some about the challenges, and then I'm going to tell you, have hope. So 27% of all forest-associated plants and animals in the United States, a total of 4,005 species, are at risk of extinction. Habitat degradation is the main reason, affecting 85% of all imperiled species, but many species are also threatened by non-native invasive species, which affect 49% of all imperiled species. And although biodiversity is exceptionally high on the national forests and grasslands, habitat degradation and invasive species remain a serious threat. Invasive weeds such as kudzu, cheatgrass, leafy spurge, and spotted knapweed have infested about 6 million acres on the national forest system. That's an area the size of Massachusetts. We've lost major forest trees, such as the American chestnut, that once stretched across vast parts of the East. Now our Appalachian coves are losing another key forest component, the eastern hemlock, crucial to the survival of native brook trout in Appalachian streams. The Forest Service has monitored watershed conditions across the entire nation, and we found that through our watershed condition framework, we've got 48% of the watersheds on national forests having low to moderate functional integrity. Functionality is actually impaired on only 3% of those watersheds. That's good news, but it's at risk in 45%, so it demands our attention. Forest density and homogeneity, that means trees that are all like each other, coupled with changes in climate, have created conditions for severe outbreaks of western forest pests. Mountain pine beetle is the main culprit, but other bark beetles, as well as western spruce budworm, have contributed to forest mortality. On national forests alone, the area affected has reached 32 million acres. So we've determined that somewhere between 65 and 82 million acres of national forests are in need of fuels and forest health treatments, up to 42% of the entire national forest system. Part of the problem is severe drought, resulting in extreme fire weather, very large fires, longer fire seasons. Since 2000, at least 10 states have had their largest fire seasons on record, and some have had that record broken more than once. In 2000, for the first time since the 1950s, more than 7 million acres burned nationwide, and in 2012, more than 9 million acres burned. The spread of homes and communities into areas prone to wildfire is an increasing management challenge. From 2000 to 2030, we expect to see substantial increases in housing density on 44 million acres of private forest land nationwide. That's an area larger than North and South Carolina combined. More than 70,000 communities are now at risk from wildfire, and less than 15,000 of those communities have a community wildfire protection plan or its equivalent. So growth and development are also reducing America's forest habitat and fragmenting what remains. From 2010 to 2060, we anticipate a net loss of forest of up to 31 million acres. A growing proportion of the Forest Service budget has been needed for fire-related activities of all kinds. In 1991, for example, fire-related activities accounted for about 13% of our total budget as an agency. In 2012, it was closer to 45%. That's left a smaller amount of funding for non-fire purposes, things like watershed restoration, wildlife habitat, recreation, other benefits and services. With increasingly limited funding, we need to approach our work differently. Most of America's landscapes are adapted to disturbances such as storms and wildfires, and they readily recover. But due to the effects of climate change and other factors, conditions have changed. Disturbances can be so severe that forest recovery is threatened, and active management is necessary to restore healthy, resilient landscapes. So I'm going to share now a few of the emerging trends in conservation that I think are helping to advance this concept of restoration. So the first one is something I'm going to call the rise of landscape conservation. Maybe it's a migration from projects to landscapes. The scale of our conservation endeavors were not effectively addressing the issues that were in front of us. When our focus was simply a project scale, a few hundred acres, a few thousand acres, while those were important projects, they weren't shifting conditions enough to generate conservation outcomes desired. Issues that are here among us required a landscape approach. If we want to recover species, if we want to ensure migratory bird flyways and habitat, if we want to recover from large fires, if we really want to address invasive species, if we want to create resilient forests, we've got to be working at a scale appropriate to what those issues demand. We also noticed that a lot of the work of the Forest Service is not just the work of the Forest Service. The issues are boundaryless. So invasive species, water issues and quality, climate impacts, they are boundaryless types of issues. It requires us to think a little bit differently about how we work. So the Forest Service began to experiment with increasing the scale of our conservation efforts, and a number of large-scale watershed restoration endeavors were launched in 2000. One of them was here in Utah. It was called the Upper Sevier Large-Scale Watershed Project. What I'd say about those is they really represented a beginning, and maybe they sowed the seeds of stronger collaborative approaches with these projects. It represented a beginning which also catalyzed our science and our management approach to look differently at delivering conservation. The other thing around landscape scale conservation is lots of other additional players began to show up. The Nature Conservancy in particular launched a number of what they called fire learning networks across the nation, which looked at landscape scale vulnerabilities and conditions, and they looked at the community values at a landscape scale. And that effort began to assist communities and the Forest Service with focused and strategic investments in restoration of fire-adapted ecosystems. So landscape scale approaches are necessary to address the challenges of contemporary conservation. Reforestation, habitat enhancements, invasive species control, hazardous fuels treatments, and other measures can help make an ecosystem more resilient and more capable of delivering benefits such as protecting water supplies and supporting native fish and wildlife. So, from projects to landscapes. The second trend I wanted to note was an increase in place-based collaboration. There was a time in the late 1980s, early 1990s, where conflicts around decisions made to manage forests were putting conservationists, industry, communities, and the Forest Service at odds with each other. And the resolution of that conflict was, in many times, to either appeal a decision or litigate a decision. So we were bound up in gridlock and in conflict. And in some places, courts deciding meant no work happened anywhere. And I think that people started to look around and say, the way we were in relationship with one another was not moving us towards conservation outcomes, and so something had to shift. And so slowly but surely, community-based work began in earnest, and the creation of people coming together around a place to create a shared vision and goals as an alternative to gridlock and conflict started to show up on the landscape. I think the other thing around place-based collaboration that began to emerge was a shift from single-interest advocacy. Maybe non-governmental organizations or interest groups that advocated solely for wildlife or fish habitat or forests or trails gave way to having concern about the place that they knew and loved, the place that they loved to visit, the place that they loved to recreate. So the single interest advocacy gave way to place-based conservation. You might say it was a migration from program to place. People connect with place, and a number of community-based collaboratives started to organize and talk about the places they cared about and all of the natural resource conditions and issues that concern them. They started to put voice to place. They named their places. The Upper Sevier Watershed was a place that community members had named and worked on together. They started to put voice to place. It also catalyzed fresh thinking on integration and the needs to work an entire watershed or landscape in a system approach to address riparian conditions, forest conditions, roads, trails, and access, watershed conditions, invasive species, wildlife, fish habitat, to ensure that we could generate the full spectrum of benefits and values important to people. Another trend that started was an increase in the number and the effectiveness of collaboratives and an increase in partnerships and volunteerism. So we already mentioned $1.2 billion of value created for conservation with communities and the Forest Service working together. Over $100 million of value in volunteer contributions for conservation. Numerous community-based organizations began to change the way we delivered conservation. There was a new authority provided by Congress a couple of years ago, 2009 actually, called the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act. And it required people who were interested in getting funds from the Forest Service to actually establish a restoration strategy for a landscape. Communities came together and did that, not being paid to do that. They weren't funded or staffed to do that, but they had a vision and a notion of what creating a set of shared outcomes would do on their landscape, and they put restoration strategies together. This new authority required it. They did it. And the strategy had to be completed before they competed for funding. So people were getting together and working in an exceptionally new way. 23 projects have been selected, but there's a lot of candidates out there that haven't been funded yet, at least another 23 to 25 projects that I know of. Another trend that's emerged in conservation is the increased strength and presence of non-governmental organizations, communities, and states. I mentioned the Nature Conservancy and their Fire Learning Network, but the Trust for Public Lands, they have a number of landscapes that they've identified as important conservation goals and landscapes for them. So too has the World Wildlife Fund, the Nature Conservancy, the Wilderness Society, Trout Unlimited, and many others. They've identified landscapes where they want to focus their conservation work. And they've brought additional science, analysis, and social license. So they stand outside the government sector as non-governmental organizations. And some have really appreciated that the science, the analysis, and the social license that they bring has really helped support and build credibility for this collaborative approach. One thing that's required from the Forest Service is for an agency that perhaps thought of itself as being expert, we are now simply bringing expertise in that there are other experts, there's other science, there's other analysis that's informing choices that we make on these public lands. So shifting from being an expert to valuing that we bring expertise and we can sit around the table and share that expertise with others. I mentioned communities and states and their leadership as well. So there is great leadership happening at the municipal level. So the city of Flagstaff, Arizona, recently passed a $10 million bond to invest in restoration of ponderosa pine forest on national forest right around the community of Flagstaff. Santa Fe, New Mexico, has done a similar type of endeavor to invest in headwater restoration. Salt Lake City and the Forest Service have had a century-old partnership to preserve high-quality drinking water for the city, but they've grown a larger endeavor recently called the Wasatch Water Legacy Partnership. They've expanded their partnership and the participation in that and broadened the goals for that particular partnership. The state of Utah has a watershed restoration initiative housed in the Division of Natural Resources. They work in 5 regional teams for strategic investments and leverage of resources. In the Blue Mountains in Colorado, the state of Oregon is actually investing hundreds of thousands of dollars to do planning so that projects can be implemented more quickly on the Blue Mountains, and that's one of the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act projects. Another trend, positive signals from partners and Congress. So I mentioned the new authority, this Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Program. It was created in 2009 to restore high-priority forested landscapes, improve forest health, promote job stability, create reliable wood supply, and reduce firefighting costs across the United States. After the program was created, the Secretary of Agriculture evaluated collaboratively with a federal advisory committee the project proposals and selected 20 large-scale projects for 10 years' worth of funding. So these projects also have certitude that they'll know they'll be getting financial resources. They also selected 3 additional projects that were really worthwhile. The footprint of those restoration strategies is some 15 million acres. It doesn't mean that those projects are going to treat or act on 15 million acres, but the consequences of those treatments will improve conditions for 15 million acres of national forest. They support an array of restoration activities, and they've created or maintained over 7,500 jobs over the last 2 years and generated almost $272 million in labor income. They reduced fire danger in almost 600,000 acres near communities, and they've enhanced clean water supplies by remediating or decommissioning 6,000 miles of road. So a very unique way of working, a very exciting authority. And there are others, things like stewardship contracting, which allows us to trade goods for services with partner organizations. The Farm Bill had requirements for state action plans, so state forestry organizations have prioritized treatments and landscapes that are important to them. Congress has also given us a pilot authority called Integrated Resource Restoration, a budget line item that's unique, that blends all of the things, the issues that I've been talking about, wildlife and fish and invasive species and forest health and forest management, in one budget line item. So structurally, it makes it very easy to take those resources and invest in what's needed, as opposed to how the pipeline of a budget line item might have looked. There's other new initiatives, one called America's Great Outdoors, where large landscape scales restoration efforts are imagined by this administration, and they have brought multiple partners together in areas that really capture the imagination of the public. So the crown of the continent in the northern Rockies, the northern forests and waters of New England, deserts of the Southwest, restoring America's longleaf pine, grasslands of the northern Great Plains. You can all get the evocative images that come up when you think about the waters in the Northeast, the grasslands of the Great Plains, the Southwest desert. So these nationally important landscapes are showing up, and people are gravitating to those as well. I wanted to mention one other new initiative that I think is really exciting. It's called the Urban Federal Waters Partnership. Urban waters in 18 locations, the federal family has convened around restoring those waters and connecting people in those urban areas to those watersheds. So there's 18. I'm going to name a couple: Anacostia River in Washington, D.C., the Bronx Harlem River in New York City, the Los Angeles River in California, the South Platte River in Colorado, the Delaware River watershed outside of Philadelphia, and many others. I only mention these places by name because they are capturing the imagination of communities in new ways. And there is a great alignment with these grassroots efforts and some of the national policy that we see: integrated resource restoration, our planning rule, the Collaborative Forest Landscape Restoration Act, and many other efforts that are treating landscapes at scale. One last example, because I think it's important to this nation to address our wildfire situation. So when Congress passed the Federal Land Assistance Management and Enhancement Act, I know, but it's got a great acronym. It's called FLAME. And the idea with FLAME was to try to help the land management agencies in the federal government with the amount of suppression costs that we were expending per year. So it imagined a fund that we could draw on when called for to fight fires. The other thing it envisioned doing was the development of a joint wildland fire management strategy across this nation from grassroots to federal scale. So working with the Department of Interior, the Forest Service has taken an opportunity to involve the entire wildland fire community in developing a joint, long-term, national, cohesive wildland fire management strategy. It's a product of a lot of collaborative efforts between fire organizations, land managers, policymaking officials. It includes federal, state, local policymakers, tribal, non-governmental organizations, and it builds on some of the successes that we have had working as an interagency family. But it's got three really important goals, and I want you to think about the cohesive strategy and remember three goals: restoring fire-adapted ecosystems. I've talked about that for a few minutes. Building fire-adapted communities, meaning those 70,000 communities at risk, we need to take proactive steps to prepare them to weather a fire. It's not a question of when. And so they need to be prepared. So the cohesive strategy imagines that. And lastly, responding appropriately to wildfire. We know that fire is good on the landscape in some situations. We know that we are called to suppress fire in other situations. Those three prongs are what the cohesive strategy is about. And I want to acknowledge that Utah is really at the forefront of executing this strategy with leadership of the governor's office, the commissioner of agriculture, and the state forester, taking actions to assess and develop plans to mitigate the risk of catastrophic wildfire in Utah. The last two things I want to mention, we've got new investors and partners in the Forest Service. We have a congressionally chartered foundation called the National Forest Foundation. We work with two other foundations, the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and the National Foundation for Environmental Education. But our foundations are generating new kinds of resources, new kinds of fundraising and friend-raising on our behalf, and they're congressionally chartered to do so. So recently, the National Forest Foundation identified 14 sites across the country, and they named them Treasured Landscapes, Unforgettable Experiences. And they went to do private fundraising and generated $62 million in private fundraising before they went public and invited people to also make contributions. Another new investor is an idea that came from the Rocky Mountain Front. It's called a Watershed Protection Partnership, Denver Water, Aurora, and a suite of other partner organizations are working to invest in the headwaters so that the impacts of fires are not felt so negatively to downstream communities. The National Fish and Wildlife Foundation is helping to restore America's longleaf pine. They're bringing private funds from Louisiana Pacific and the Southern Company to help restore longleaf pine across the southern tier of the United States. The National Forest Foundation also has something called a Ski Area Conservation Fund, and Snowbird was the first resort that actually joined the Ski Area Conservation Fund, and as a consequence of an additional dollar on your overnight stay or an additional dollar on your lift ticket, that money is being plowed directly back into conservation. So organizations like the Cottonwood Canyons Foundation are putting money back into getting youth crews out to manage trails. They're getting youth crews out to do watershed restoration. Very exciting partnership. And there's lots more. We have a capital carbon fund where people who want to reforest to offset carbon emissions are able to invest through our Forest Foundation. So the Disney Corporation and Chevrolet are working to plant trees on national forests to offset carbon emissions and their footprint. And there's many, many more. I'm going to close with just a couple more thoughts. With all of these partners, with all of these community-based collaboratives, we have new coalitions of people interested in conservation. I've mentioned the Nature Conservancy, the Wilderness Society. There was not a time when the Wilderness Society and the Forest Service would have been, well, harmonized in terms of our vision for the future. They actually have a restoration strategy. They have a restoration team at the national level. And when you read their restoration strategy, it's really hard to see how that didn't come from the Forest Service and how ours didn't come from the Wilderness Society. American Forest, Society of American Foresters, Sustainable Northwest, National Association of State Foresters, National Association of Counties, there's broad support for increasing the pace and scale of restoration. And they're saying so, and they're activating in terms of advocating for the resources necessary, and they're also telling the story about the power of community-based collaboration and its positive outcomes. So there are challenges in conservation and certainly different viewpoints about progress that's being made and roles to be played. But I still find that there's great hope and inspiration to be drawn from how people are working together. It's part of why I'm here. I want to make a difference in people's lives. I want to make a difference on the land. I want to make a difference in how we collectively steward a legacy of public lands and public service. So what I'm working on is growing a constituency for conservation and increasing environmental literacy, growing the next generation of conservation leaders, maintaining the level of curiosity, passion, and optimism that brought me here, and lastly, to increase civil discourse and participation to help people discover their connection to the land. So I'm going to close on this last note. Gifford Pinchot, the first chief of the Forest Service, argued in 1907 that the national forests exist today because the people want them. He declared that the citizenry must assume the primary responsibility for determining their political context and their environmental management. He said, "To make them accomplish the most good, the people themselves must make clear how they want them run." He never assumed the public would always be in agreement. In fact, Pinchot's most famous maxim was predicated on discord, and he said, "And where conflicting interests must be reconciled, the questions will always be decided from the standpoint of the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run." So I invite you to join us in the pursuit of finding the greatest good. Thank you.
We have a few minutes left for questions. If you have a question, please wait for the mic. I'll bring it around. Please state your name also, and please only wait for the mic, because we are recording this.
Hi, Hi, my name is Rachel, and I'm a political science student here at the U. My question is about, it seems like a lot of the programs and initiatives you're talking about today are a partnership between the Forest Service and the Department of Interior agencies. And I'm curious what challenges or strengths you see in the Forest Service being under the Department of Agriculture, whereas other organizations you work with are under the Department of Interior.
Rachel, great question. Thanks. So we all have origins and roots and histories, and the Forest Service certainly has a history. We were originally, when the Forest Reserves were established, they were established under the General Land Office of the Department of the Interior. So we have roots back to the Department of Interior. There was a case to be made by the president and a political operative in Gifford Pinchot, who actually strategized getting the Forest Service out of Department of Interior. And part of that was because the General Land Office, the origin and root of the Bureau of Land Management and managing a federal estate, was a new concept and hadn't really been brought to complete fruition through the General Land Office. And Gifford Pinchot and Teddy Roosevelt, they conceived and thought that the Forest Service would be best positioned to manage this public estate on behalf of citizens if they were in the Department of Agriculture. Today, what I would say, Rachel, is it's a really good point. We do a tremendous amount of coordination, collaboration, cooperation with our colleagues from Department of the Interior. We show up on landscapes together. We show up in wildfire suppression together. But it's not unlike the job that we have to do with states, municipalities, non-governmental organizations. There's a collaboration job to do everywhere. I'll leave it to other people who are going to decide the fate of the Forest Service over time, but I appreciate the history and the roots, and we work really, really hard to make that seamless and make our contributions in unique ways, but in furthering conservation as a whole.
Hi, my name is Gavin Noyes, and I'm a MPP student here at the U. And I have a question about, you talked a lot about collaborations, and my question is about the role of Native American tribes. And, you know, they've got deep interests in Forest Service land, their ancestral land. And I just wonder, you know, I see the Forest Service as being one of the leaders in that collaboration with tribes, but what more is the Forest Service doing that?
Thanks. Great question, Gavin. So an additional authority that we've got from Congress is something called the Tribal Forest Protection Act, which gives us some ability in our nation-to-nation, sovereign-to-sovereign relationship with tribes to work with them across the boundaries of the tribal lands and the national forests, and where there are interests that we share, to work together. So there's a number of Tribal Forest Protection Act projects across the West. Tribal nations are also showing up remarkably and importantly in a number of these landscape scale collaboratives. And I'm thinking about one in the state of Washington called the Tapash, initiated by the Nature Conservancy and the state of Washington, a broad consortium of players, and the Yakima Nation is playing a really vital role there. The relationship is different. The federal responsibility to tribal nations is a sovereign-to-sovereign relationship. We treat them differently than we do partners. We don't think of tribal nations as partners. We think of the leaders as distinct and as sovereigns themselves. So we have a specific set of things like consultation that we will do on certain things that we're considering, where we actually engage with tribes in a very different, unique way than we do with the general public at large, for instance, because of that sovereign nation status. There's more work to do, to be sure, and if you've got ideas, I'd really love to hear them.
Hi, I'm Lee. I have a very answer.
Currently, U-150 from Camas to Emerson, Wyoming, which crosses National Forest property, is a toll road. If you plan on using any of the facilities on the highway, you have to purchase a pass in order to stop and use them. And then the money from this pass goes back into either our local area or American Fort Canyon.
And the two areas are both tied together with this toll.
Do you know of other projects in the National Forest Service that are doing that, or is there plans to expand that? Any idea that will grow, that program will grow?
So the authority from Congress that allows us to collect fees in our high-value recreation settings is an authorization that comes from Congress. It's been controversial. There are people who oppose fees. They feel like they've paid taxes, so why should they have to buy an additional pass? But in some locations, we have very intense recreation use, and the ability to collect a fee and put it back into that site so the facilities are clean, the trailheads are maintained, the signage is up to standard is also seen as an advantage by some constituents. I could get you more information on where else those high recreation sites are in the nation.
My name is Jack. I'm a student at the University of Utah, but I grew up in Hood River, Oregon. It's a community that relies heavily on timber payments, or at least did in the past. But when the spotted owl was put on the endangered species list, along with other Forestry Service conservation efforts, much of the economic base of the surrounding community was undercut. In exchange, the federal government offered timber payments to help support local schools and police departments, but now those timber payments are drying up. So I guess my question is, how do we balance economic development for these communities and conservation, and what solutions are available to these communities now that timber payments are drying up?
The authorization from Congress is something called Secure Rural Schools, and so a certain percentage of the proceeds from all kinds of receipts generated from activities on national forests, including special use authorizations from utility companies and power lines, as well as harvesting of trees and other kinds of activities, generate proceeds. And a percentage of those proceeds are paid right back to counties to help fund schools and roads and emergency services. A certain percentage of those are also available to the county to put into natural resource stewardship, and a number of counties avail themselves of that opportunity. It's been an authority that has had broad support from Western members of Congress. It has struggled for reauthorization at times. I think it has expired at this point, Secure Rural Schools, but I believe it's being reauthorized in the Farm Bill, or maybe it got passed in the omnibus. I'm apologize for not being completely clear on that. But the point is, there are a lot of people who see the importance of, when you're not able to develop a tax base or subdivisions or grow industry because you have a high percentage of national forest or public lands in your county, there needs to be some sort of offset or balancing to that activity. I will just mention that surprisingly, again, the proceeds that come from the activities on national forests that generate the most amount of revenue at this point in time are recreationally based activities. You've heard me advocate a strong stance on the importance of restoration, and with restoration will come opportunities for wood products, small diameter wood and trees to be harvested off national forests. We have increased our timber output the last couple of years in spite of sequester and in spite of limited resources. I think that shows a strong commitment to making some of those choices and making sure that we can help to fund Secure Rural Schools. Right now, it comes out of the Forest Service's appropriated dollars. So we have, as an agency, carved out Secure Rural Schools payment out of our appropriated dollars. It's that important to this administration.
I'm Thad Hall, a professor here at the University of Utah. The answer you just gave to that question raises some issues about the private use of public lands. And so, for instance, when power lines are running through national forests or things like that, can you talk a little bit about your ability to actually get money from private actors who are doing activities on these lands, and if you're constrained by old laws and things like that to keep you from getting the actual value for what you for what people are getting from it?
We authorize activities, occupancy and use of national forests through different kinds of authorities. So for a transmission line, power line corridor, oil and gas pipeline, and the like, a company would have to ask for an authorization. We'd have to look at the environmental effects and impacts of that activity. And when we authorized it, it would be by way of something called a special use authorization or a special use permit. And we recover a certain amount of proceeds from different activities that are authorized on national forests, everything from ski areas to outfitter guides to recreational resorts to utility corridors and power lines, microwave towers, communication towers is another. We don't have the authority to collect full market value for some of those activities.
My name's Carl Fisher. I'm the director of a local conservation organization here, Save Our Canyons. And my question really is about wilderness. And it seems that fewer and fewer wilderness bills have been passed by Congress over the past few years. And I was just wondering, in the face of climate change, in the face of a threat to our watersheds, if the Forest Service sees wilderness designation as a tool to not just restore but to permanently preserve some of these landscapes, and what you are doing to realize more wilderness protected on our national forests.
So only Congress has the authority to designate wilderness. In the case of bills that Congress introduces and the administration testifies to, our stance has been pretty positive to bills that have been introduced. In a lot of cases in today's world, the introduction of a bill is predicated on bipartisan support. So the Democrats and the Republicans in a state that are proposing wilderness designation have to be together on that. Those bills are being received very favorably when the administration testifies. Congress has not been enacting wilderness legislation. The other way we influence what happens in terms of preserving options for the future is in our land and resource management plans. So much like municipalities or counties, we do master plans. They're called forest plans. And we assess the wilderness characteristics and the roadless area on national forests for consideration into potential wilderness designation. So we do hold, just by way of our own planning process, some of those lands in abeyance until they can be considered for wilderness. They are important reservoirs of refugia, high water quality, and they have tremendous values. And if you leave me your card, I'll share a document with you where an interagency group of leaders has come together in preparation for the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act, and they've actually looked at the benefits and values that accrue to American public because of the quality of conditions of wilderness areas.
Now, unfortunately, that is all the time we have for questions. Please join me in thanking our guest. And if you would like to hear this broadcast again, it will be played on Wednesday at 10 a.m. on 88.3 on KWPC. Thank you.
Just in closing, Associate Chief Wagner has agreed to meet here at 1:30 with any students. She would like to talk with people about careers in the environment, whether or not with the Forest Service. So if you're interested as a student to stay around, we're going to take a break, let people leave, and then she will meet.